Your Honor, this case has one issue to it. As you know, it involves the unfortunate death of Mr. Martin. And I anticipate one of the questions, or probably not the most important question, is had it not been for the accident caused by Mr. Levinson, would Mr. Martin even be in that hospital receiving the treatment that he received? Of course, there's the proximate cause. Of course, there's intervening facts. We maintain that the accident that Mr. Levinson caused, which resulted in survivable injuries, injuries to a spleen, injuries to a leg, that is separate from the intervening choice that Mr. Martin made later on. And Mr. Martin was confronted with a couple of options for treatment. And one of those options, of course, was to put a stent into the leg to avoid amputation.
You read this record perhaps a little differently than I do, because I don't see this as necessarily a choice by the victim as much as him giving informed consent to the doctor to proceed with the treatment that the doctor felt most appropriate. I mean, this is not a case where the doctor came in and said, look, we can do A or we can do B, your choice.
And I understand your point, Your Honor. My viewing of it, or my reading of, the doctors made sure that they relayed the risk involved in choosing to have the stent put in and having heparin introduced as part of the treatment. That we know from the record, because there's a three-doctor panel. We also know from Dr. Howda's testimony that oftentimes, if an individual is in a trauma, they aren't introduced the heparin because of that fear of having the brain bleed or any other bleeding involved in the body.
But here, the situation, to follow up on Judge Petty's question, was it was a certainty that he would lose his leg. If the doctors, all the doctors who testified, said he would lose his leg, it would have to be amputated if he did not go this route. Now, there's the alternatives, but you know you're going to lose your leg because of this accident you were just in. So why is that just an option?
Well, there's multiple, and there's a part of the record where it is discussed whether or not the stent could be put in without the introduction of heparin. And the stent could have been put in without heparin.
But that was not the medically advisable method.
It may not have been the medically advisable method. However, it is still a choice that introduced, made by the decedent in this, that he decided to take the heparin, which ultimately caused the death.
Would your argument be the same if the defendant said, now I want you to go ahead and take my leg, and as they were amputating the leg, something unfortunate, unforeseen happened, and he died from that?
I think the argument would be, well, it would be different. I may be a little bit confused, but in that situation, if the injuries were a result of the accident, then yes. But in this case, the heparin is what actually caused the injury that killed Mr. Martin.
Do we know whether an aneurysm or some bleeding in the brain, do we know whether that was caused by the accident at all?
We don't know that for sure, and that's part of the argument that we have. It's subject to just mere speculation. We have Dr. Howda, who testifies, I believe in page of the appendix, page 792, that the brain bleed, the actual pattern that's found in the CAT scans, because they did determine, prior to giving him the heparin, there was no indicia of bleeding in the brain, and we know that from a CAT scan. But Dr. Howda says that it seems as if that bleeding that was in there was not consistent with trauma.
What's the best case you can give us to support your argument that this is an intervening cause?
I don't believe that there's actually a case on all points here. The example I can give, and what I would...
you've given us a bunch of civil case law.
Yes.
To support your proposition, contrary to Mr. Jeffrey's criminal case law.
I would also point out that Mr. Jeffrey did include many cases that are outside of the Commonwealth of Virginia to make his points. The example that I would give is if Mr. Martin was unconscious when he went to the hospital and was unable to give that consent, and the doctors didn't put the heparin, Mr. Martin perhaps would have woken up at worst with an amputated leg. That's where the, I apologize, Your Honor.
That's all right. Let's get that baseline correct, because the Supreme Court has held that, quote, established principles of proximate causation are applicable to both civil and criminal cases.
Correct.
So don't we look to civil cases in trying to determine what a superseding cause is?
We do. They go hand in hand, the causal connection and one aspect that, you know, that we noted, I noted in my brief was, as far as the intervening cause and our position that his decision broke that chain that criminalized Mr. Levinson's action, the evidence of the heparin, we maintain the heparin is what caused the death. The choice to take that heparin caused the death. The record is unclear whether or not the heparin itself caused it.
A brain bleed caused the death,
but it's up to speculation from Dr. I can't pronounce his name. It's NG. It may be NG. There's no vowels. I don't know how to pronounce that. But
in Commonwealth versus Jenkins, it's a Supreme Court case, 1998. A defendant died in the hospital 4 days after he was shot from aspiration of his vomit. And the Supreme Court said, when a defendant has inflicted wounds upon a victim that result in affliction or a disease, the defendant is criminally responsible for the victim's death from that affliction or disease if the wounds caused the death indirectly through a chain of natural effects and causes. An intervening event, even if it causes the death, does not exempt the defendant from liability if that event was put into operation by the defendant's initial criminal acts.
And I agree with that case, and that's why.
Why doesn't that control?
Because we believe that the fact that the defendant, the decedent, was exposed to this option, two different options, and one of which did not have the risk of death.
So
the
you
other
wouldn't
one
be
had
here.
The risk.
So your position is you wouldn't be here if the doctors just did the procedure and he died of the aneurysm.
I don't know whether or not they would be able to do the procedure without the consent.
If he's unconscious.
If he's unconscious, they may not have been able to do it without the consent. And that's something that I feel the Commonwealth should have proved. They are clear. Dr. MG is very clear. He says he got the written consent on putting the stent. He wishes he had gotten the written consent on putting in the heparin, but that was just done verbally. That, assuming that they required the consent, if Mr. Martin was unconscious and came into the hospital and they were unable to get anybody to consent to do that procedure, he may very well be alive, and Mr. Levinson would, at worst, be facing a maiming case instead of a manslaughter. Those are the points. I understand. The but-for argument is paramount. It's had it not been for the argument, would he be in there? And that case, the Jenkins case, it may be natural for him to vomit. But in this case, it's unclear whether or not the heparin actually caused this brain bleed. It's unclear whether or not the brain bleed was from a prior stroke prior to the accident, or if it was someone with high blood pressure, which are all things that Dr. Howda testified to possible causes for a brain bleed, including trauma.
But he wouldn't have been taking heparin had it not been for your client driving drunk and having an accident.
Our position is he was put in that position because of the accident. But our position is that the independent choice that he had broke the chain. So it's...
Well, how do you respond, though? In 2015, this court said, furthermore, an intervening event, even if a cause of the harm, does not operate to exempt a defendant from liability if the intervening event was put into operation by the defendant's negligent acts, criminal case Hawkins.
You're right. However, in this case, what we're lacking as far as the sufficiency of the evidence is whether or not that heparin exacerbated a prior injury from the brain, which was not something that arose from the accident itself. The heparin itself may have caused that injury or exacerbated a prior existing injury. We don't know.
I've got to go back to the bar exam for the last time that I studied negligence law, but I remember a concept that you take a person as you find them when it comes to negligence acts. I remember the old eggshell skull case or something to that effect.
I
mean, whether this weakness in the blood vessel in his brain was pre-existing, whether it was caused by the accident, that doesn't matter. What matters is he died as a result of the administration of a drug for purposes of treating him for injuries sustained in this accident.
That is true, and I feared the eggshell question as well. That's the difference, what I maintain is the difference here is the decedent had two options, and those two options, one of which was to not have the heparin, the other one was to take a riskier choice.
Well, didn't one of the doctors essentially say it wasn't an option, that it was a last resort if the stent didn't work?
My reading of that, and it could be wrong, I reread that, I was under the impression that if a stent was put in, it could be put in without the heparin. What could happen, since the body naturally fights in a foreign substance, it could start to reclot. At that point there, the leg could become toxic. It was substantially riskier.
Because of the additional clotting.
Clotting. It could have caused
that. Isn't that why the doctor said that, you know, they really wouldn't do the procedure? It's my understanding. Maybe I'm wrong about this, but wouldn't do the procedure without doing the heparin.
But I do recall Dr. Howda saying that on some cases, the individual just is not a good candidate for heparin, and they still have to remove that blood clot.
I just
don't know. Someone involved in a trauma.
But also, we have to look at light most favorable to the Commonwealth at this juncture in terms of the evidence.
We do, which is why we maintain that the Commonwealth failed to even establish, a couple of things, the when the injury occurred that caused the heparin to exacerbate that, that's absent, and it's subject to mere speculation. And there's two conflicting forms of testimony. Dr. Howda says that it doesn't appear to be from a trauma, and you have Dr. NG saying that perhaps it was caused by the accident, but we don't know. That's subject to speculation, which at that point there, in our brief, the evidence tending to show causal connections must be sufficient to take the question out of the realm of mere conjecture, speculation, or into the realm of legitimate inference. So it's a novel. I didn't find a specific case, a criminal case. They do combine this proximate cause issue with civil liability and contributory
negligence. But you only go there when there's not criminal law right on point.
Correct. And I don't see a case right on point where an individual, his independent decision to do a riskier avenue. And I would maintain
Why do you say that that's riskier? Because I think that a blood thinner is a lot safer than cutting somebody's leg off. This victim simply, unfortunately, had an undiscovered weakness in a blood vessel in his brain. But the doctor wasn't suggesting this because it was a riskier procedure.
What? Riskier in terms of the risk of death. One had no risk of death and the other one did. And what I would ask...
Are you saying that cutting somebody's leg off poses no risk of death?
The record, from what I read on the record, I recall that I don't recall them saying that there was a risk of death if there was an amputee. That would have, as a last resort, would have been done. What I would maintain, and Your Honor, I would respond with another example. I know as the court looks down on this, but what if the choice was an individual had a blood clot and the person may lose a finger and chose to do the blood thinner rather than lose the finger? I'm not sure if the risk of the particular limb has any role in this, but the fact is one had an explained risk of death and the other one, from what I understand from the record, did not explain a risk of death on the amputee.
All right. You've got a little time remaining for rebuttal. We'll tack on an additional minute or two because of our aggressive questioning. Thank you. Mr. Jeffries.
Good afternoon, May please court. Donald Jeffrey on behalf of the Commonwealth. I, first of all, a clerical problem. Garcia, I cited in the brief from the Supreme Court of Iowa, and I gave an erroneous site. I said 619 Northwest 2nd 594. It's actually 616 Northwest 2nd 594. I'll try to do something written to rectify that, but I just picked up on that problem yesterday. As the court has alluded to already, I have cited a number of cases, including Gallimore, talks a lot about the defendant's action putting this in motion, and if the outcome is something that's reasonably foreseeable. Gallimore, I would submit to the court, although it's not a medical care case, certainly is, to me, a lot more attenuated than any causation in this particular case. I would submit to you, Judge Petty, I agree with what you said about eggshell victim. I think one of the out-of-state cases I talked about actually said that. I would submit to you that issue is not really before you by the assignment of error. The assignment and the argument, as I understood it, was very narrowly limited to this individual made a choice to take the heparin, which had some degree of risk of death associated with it, and that ended up being not just an intervening but a superseding cause. I think one of the doctors, I believe, actually did address that, at least some speculative realm, and if that's an important issue to the court, I'll try to nail that down with more particularity. I don't want to just wing it standing up here, but I would submit to you that what you have here, if it was a choice, it was in fact a Hobson's choice, and it was one that was created by the defendant's actions. This guy didn't have a good option. Do something that doesn't involve heparin, even assuming the defendant's right that that carried no risk of death. I think when the doctor was asked that question, the testimony was essentially to the effect of, we don't need to use the heparin. We essentially take the leg and we sew that up and we're done. I don't know that he was ever specifically asked about any risk of death, although, as Judge Petty alluded to a minute ago, it would seem to me that to say that there's no risk of death from that procedure seems to me a little odd, but I don't believe we have the experts saying that, so I'm not really sure what their answer would have been to that question. The case law from this court very much talks in terms of issues of causation generally being fact questions. I cited Forbes, which is actually a case where this court found as a matter of law that the government had not proven its case. That, I don't believe, is the issue you have here. Again, partly because of the decisions, the tough decisions that the victim had to make in this case. I would also point out, as I did on brief, he had to make a very snap decision, and a tough decision for anybody. The biggest this window ever got was 5 hours, according to the doctor's testimony, and I would submit to you, as I suggested on brief, that window, based on the doctor's testimony, and I'm wrestling with the two, I think it's Inge, but I'm not sure. He began interacting with this man, the way I read the record, several hours after the accident, the collision, and if it's 5 hours from the date from the time of impact, I would suggest to you that it really was a very, very narrow window here, but even make it 5 hours, I wouldn't want to have to make that decision in 5 hours myself. I'd probably be on the phone with half the people I know. We have, as the court's spoken about, we have cases, many cases from out of state that address this issue. It most typically comes up in the context of either a family member or, in at least one of the cases I cited, the victim himself making a decision to pull life support. While that is, in fact, a proximate cause, maybe even an intervening cause, to use the terms that are in the case law and the statutes, it is not, in fact, a superseding cause. Again, the jury was properly instructed here, and this comes from the case law, that, I want to use the exact language, the independent intervening act that alone causes the victim's injury or death is recognized as a superseding cause that will exempt the defendant from criminal responsibility for his or her conduct.
I take it then that whether this was a superseding cause or not was a factual finding made by the jury.
Absolutely. That issue was submitted to the jury. And the sole issue in front of you, Judge Petty, as I think correctly stated by the assignment of error, was, to paraphrase it, was the trial court wrong in submitting this to the jury is a factual question. And again, I think based on this court's case law in cases like Forbes, those types of issues about causation, whether it be superseding or intervening, are almost always factual questions to be submitted to the fact finder, bench trial. If it's bench trial, obviously the trial judge decides it. Here, that again, you've got a general rule that there's no place for contributory negligence in the analysis typically. You've got the case law. The court talked about it, talked about the things that are in Gallimore. If the defendant's actions put them in, put the chain of events in motion, I think you clearly have that here. The defendant's negligent, grossly negligent actions are what caused the need for the defendant and the doctors to make these difficult decisions and give this difficult advice.
Mr. Jeffrey, does it make any difference if the, let's assume this victim came in by ambulance and the same doctor, Dr. NG, is faced with an unconscious victim and his makes the medical choice to proceed forward as he did, and you have the brain bleed versus the amputation. Does it matter?
I'm not sure I understand.
In terms of a legal analysis, does it matter whether the victim makes a choice or whether the victim, as an unconscious victim, comes in and a medical decision is made?
The doctor makes a medical decision without the consent of the victim.
Correct.
That's the question. No, I don't think it does, because you still have the same issue about the chain of events being put in motion. The doctor uses his best judgment. You actually allude to something that comes up in many of the cases that I cited, Judge Decker. The dividing line, at least with some courts, and probably most of the courts I'm familiar with, is negligent medical care is reasonably foreseeable. The West Virginia case I cited actually quoted some out of state authority for that proposition. That we hope it's rare, but in terms of the foreseeability analysis that you're using in this type of case, that is actually chargeable to the defendant based on the law that you have in most jurisdictions. There are some, and I could give you which cases talk about this. There are some that say grossly negligent medical care is not foreseeable, but I have not yet found anybody who said that the line is any further to the left than that. So your hypothetical didn't posit any type of malpractice, so that was my long-winded way of saying absolutely not. The defendant set this chain of events in motion. To kind of plug in the various factors, it reasonably foreseeable that someone that has this kind of injury won't be in a position to make that decision for himself, and whether it's a physician who's making it on his own in the first instance, which I suspect is probably allowed if it's a life-threatening issue, or whether it's a family member, back to my life support and termination cases, whether a family member's making the call, ultimately that is something that is not a defense, and certainly is something that could be submitted to the jury as it was in this case.
On those, because I just want to clear how analogous these are. On the life support situations, we have a statute in Virginia on that.
Correct.
That says that terminating life support is not a superseding cause if this, this, and this. Does that pretty much preclude relying on any of these life support decisions that you cited? Is that a significant distinction in Virginia versus the out-of-state cases?
Yeah, I don't know if it's a civil statute you're talking about. Is it an 801
somewhere? No, it's a criminal. I know as a prosecutor, I used it in homicide cases once or twice.
I think the answer is no. I think the short answer is you revert to the common law. I think we apply the common law as best I can tell in the absence of a statute. There is something statutory there that makes it clear that is the law. It's probably an issue that's been raised enough that the General Assembly saw a need to clarify and make the point express. The problem with statutes is you can't conjure up every possible scenario. I would suggest to you, Judge Petty, that the life support one is kind of an easy one. It's probably come up quite a bit. This thing about heparin versus no heparin, and you have to agree to have your leg taken so you don't have to take the heparin. I'm not even sure how you write that statute, but our common law covers the point and has not been abrogated by statute. I suppose that probably.
I just didn't want to rely on termination of life support cases too much, because I saw that as possibly taking that space in Virginia, that statute. I didn't look up the statute.
And certainly, to be fair, at least one of the cases, if not more, that I talk about on brief, actually do mention the fact that you have an absolute right to refuse life-sustaining treatment or to be pulled off of it. It probably arises in statutes in those cases, but I don't believe that the analysis with respect to intervening and superseding causes in those cases is completely useless in this case, notwithstanding that we don't have a statute applicable to this type of scenario. One of the things that I would leave you with in this case, because I thought that this was probably one of the best articulations of why we have these rules, is from the Indiana case that I cited on brief, that in order for it to be a superseding cause, the intervening cause would have to be so extraordinary that it would be unfair to hold the defendant criminally liable for what the outcome was. I think when we blow past all the statements about contributory negligence not having a place in this type of law, things like why do we have the year and a day rule, which of course has been abrogated by statute in some states, that's what you end up coming around to. And I think when you're applying the actual case law, that's one of the considerations that ought to be in your mind. Is there anything that's extraordinarily unfair about holding the defendant criminally liable for what happened here? And I suggest that it's not.
So gross negligence by the physician in treating him might be a superseding cause, but sort of general negligence, I did the best I could, weighing the options here where you might get a malpractice suit wouldn't be enough to be a superseding cause.
That tends to be, and I cited the cases on brief, the West Virginia case.
And just to be clear, there's no evidence of medical negligence in this case whatsoever.
Absolutely not. To me, Judge Decker, I think the analogy here, if there is one with those cases, would be, did this guy make a decision on his own, did this victim make a decision on his own that was so, I guess I'll use the term radical, because I don't know how a layperson can make a negligent decision. Was the decision he made here so radical that we ought to absolve this defendant from liability? If there is an analogy to the medical malpractice cases, I think that's what it would be.
I kind of see it as if confronted with the loss of a limb that he decided to commit suicide in the hospital. That would be an intervening cause.
Yeah, yes. I think
you might argue it the other way.
Or your opposing counsel's scenario of, amputation of a pinky versus, having brain surgery or whatever.
Possibly so. I think I'd probably make that argument to you. Even so, if a jury accepted that as not being an intervening cause, I still think that's a tough decision. It's easy in this case to make the argument because we're actually talking about a leg. And we're not just talking about a leg. I would point this out, too. We're talking about, because both of the doctors talked about the likelihood that this amputation would have to be above the knee, the impact that would have in terms of the prosthesis and things that you could do. Now, there wasn't an absolute certainty. I want to be completely clear about the record on that. But that seemed to be the way that they were leaning. In fact, I want to say the one doctor may have pulled a 90-odd percent number out of thin air during his testimony. But they both seemed pretty adamant on that was the most likely outcome. And I don't know that the doctors mentioned this in terms of how they gave their advice, but I went back and did the math from the autopsy report, which is in the appendix, I think at page 1090, and this gentleman wasn't even 30 years old, and I think that certainly plays a role. I think perhaps you make different decisions at that point, and that certainly was something that was before the fact finder as well. So I see I'm very close to running out of time. Did that answer your question, Judge Decker? I said most of this on brief. Much of what was here was foreseeable. Driving drunk, that someone would get injured in your car, the person would be transported to the hospital and would rely on the advice of the doctors, and that he would try to save his leg. All of that was foreseeable. I would also point out that the doctors, although the CT scan was not an absolute certainty, I think if you go through this record and everything I talked about, these were doctors, and there's no dispute about this, who were trying to be careful and give the best advice that they possibly could. And I think when you wrap that all up in this case, and if I could just finish briefly here, my red light's on, that the evidence was adequate for this to be submitted to the jury to not strike this, and I would ask that you affirm the judgment of the Fairfax Circuit Court.
Thank you. Mr. Silveira, we'll tack another minute onto your time there. So
thank you.
Haven't got a whole lot left.
The one issue I wanted to point out, a couple issues. The life support cases, I think,
there's a fundamental difference in the facts of this case. And unfortunately, I just have nothing but analogies or examples to offer. If someone refused medical care for religious beliefs, that is an independent choice. There's an option for life-saving techniques. The other option, I choose to rely on religion. Perhaps it works, perhaps it doesn't, but that's his free choice. That is something that he's confronted with that. And despite the recommendations of all the doctors, despite the fact that, like in this case, there's a three-panel group of doctors who are advising this individual, I don't know, and to be fair, Your Honor, it may be in there, or Your Honors, it may be in there, I don't recall it ever being couched as a recommendation. I believe it being couched as, this is what can happen, this is how serious heparin can be, you make the choice. Now, the point that we also make is that the superseding fact is the decision to take the heparin, and the heparin breaks that chain from Mr. Levinson. Doesn't completely eliminate his criminal liability for a maiming, doesn't eliminate the fact that Mr. Martin is in the hospital and injured, but it does eliminate the criminal liability, the chain that brings it up to a manslaughter, involuntary manslaughter. Those are the only points I have.
Thank you very much. We will greet counsel. Our next case is Boone versus Boone.